Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. Today, we're plunging into a topic that's, well, it's really shifted how we think about global conflict. We're talking about Russia's evolving military conduct and this whole concept of hybrid warfare. You've probably heard the chatter lately. Hybrid warfare is dead long live mobilization. Especially, you know, after Russia's 2022 campaign in Ukraine seemed to swap that earlier finesse for just frontal assaults. So we're going to unpack that today and ask, was the Gerasimov Doctrine ever really a guide for Russian strategy?
Yeah, and in understanding this, it isn't just some academic exercise. It's pretty vital for anyone tracking global security, really.
Yeah.
Because it shapes how nations, maybe even how you listening, assess and respond to Russian actions. So we're aiming to distill the most crucial takeaways from some really excellent sources, give you those sharp aha insights without, you know, the usual information overload.
Absolutely. And this deep dive is brought to you by the Security Nexus. We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We specialize in strategic advisory, education, and public engagement. Through things like this deep dive, our blogs, training, consulting, we provide insight into the evolving landscape, cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy. Our mission is really to inform, educate, and empower both professionals and the public. We want to give you clear, accessible, actionable knowledge. You can find more of our insights over at thesecuritynexus.net. And for today's deep dive, we're drawing on some great work from authors like Dmitry Adamski, Charles K. Bartles, Rogier Donkersloot, Andrew Monahan, Miguel Pico, Lars Gartner, Fu Ayaman, and also articles from places like Military Review and the Eastern Europe Study Center.
Okay, so to really get our heads around Russia's approach, let's start right at the beginning. This whole idea of hybrid warfare and the so-called Gerasimov Doctrine, where did that actually come from?
Right, let's unpack that origin story. The term Gerasimov Doctrine itself, it really traces back to a 2013 article written by General Valery Gerasimov himself, who is chief of the Russian General Staff. In it, he talked about what he saw as these blurring boundaries between war and peace. And he highlighted the increasing role of non-military tools, stuff like information operations, psychological warfare, economic pressure, that kind of thing. He even pointed to the Arab Spring as an example of, you know, rapid political collapse happening without a formal declaration of war.
And here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Western observers, especially right after the 2014 Crimea annexation, they jumped on this article. Many interpreted it as a kind of manifesto, you know, a blueprint for a Russian hybrid war. But, and this is a key point from sources like Charles Bartles, Gerasimov likely never intended to lay out a Russian doctrine. His article was arguably more of an observation of Western methods, specifically things like U.S. tactics in regime change operations. It wasn't a prescription for Russia. In fact, you'll find Russian officers themselves often calling the Gerasimov Doctrine a Western invention. Some even say it's a Western hybrid tactic aimed at Russia.
Wow, okay. That's a huge distinction, isn't it? So it sounds like Russia was observing, maybe learning, but not necessarily broadcasting their own playbook, and realizing that it really changes how we should maybe interpret Russia's strategic communication, challenges some assumptions in Western defense circles, maybe. But okay, this core idea relying on indirect asymmetrical means that's not exactly brand new for Russia, is it? Where do these tactics really come from?
No, not at all. The core concepts have really deep roots. It draws heavily from Soviet era tactics like Maskirovka, which is basically all about deception, denial, camouflage, a concept we'll probably touch on more when we talk information warfare. And this has evolved over time into what some analysts now call new generation warfare, or NGW. This NGW emphasizes cross-domain operations, hitting multiple areas at once and focusing maybe more on psychological impact than just capturing territory.
Okay, so if we look at it through that lens, that practical lens, it makes the shift we saw between Crimea in 2014 and the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 even more, well, stark. Russia's 2014 operation in Crimea was incredibly surgical, almost slick. We all remember the little green men, right? Unmarked soldiers. Combined with digital disinformation campaigns, really rapid political manipulation using local proxies. Western strategists looked at that and basically said, okay, this is hybrid warfare, fluid, deniable.
Exactly. And then you contrast that sharply with 2022. Russia's invasion of Ukraine starting then has been, by most accounts, a conventional disaster in many ways. The initial Kremlin attempt at a quick blitzkrieg-style decapitation of Kyiv, it failed spectacularly. Yeah. And what followed was this grinding, high-intensity, attritional warfare. We're talking sieges, trenches, massive artillery duels, missile barrages. Very different picture. That fluid hybrid model seemed largely replaced by just brute force and mass mobilization.
Mm.
Strategies that feel much more like the old Soviet playbook, frankly.
Right, a completely different feel. So that paints a clear picture of the shift. But why? Why did Russia pivot from that, you know, more nuanced approach in Crimea to the brutal conventional fight we're seeing now?
Well, the consensus seems to be leaning towards necessity rather than strategic choice. Ukraine's military had changed dramatically between 2014 and 2022. They were integrating NATO-style tactics, training, getting better equipment, and they adapted remarkably quickly to the kind of hybrid threats Russia threw at them earlier. So once that ambiguity and misdirection, the deniability, once that failed to deliver rapid strategic wins in 2022, conventional warfare, despite its immense cost for Russia, arguably became the Kremlin's only remaining path to try and achieve its objectives. Though, you know, the success of that is obviously highly debatable.
That makes a lot of sense. A shift born from the failure of the initial approach. So, okay, while the grand, subtle hybrid plan might have stalled or failed in 2022, that doesn't mean Russia just threw out its entire non-conventional toolkit, right? What elements of that broader approach are still relevant, still being used, even while the tanks are rolling?
Oh, absolutely not. Key elements persist. A huge one is information warfare, or IW. Its legacy, as I mentioned, is deeply tied to Maskirovka, this long, long history of deception in Russian and Soviet military thought. It was absolutely core to Soviet military campaigns, from tactical feints all the way up to grand strategic deception during World War II, for example.
And Maskirovka wasn't static, it evolved, didn't it, into this concept called reflexive control, or RC theory. Which sounds pretty sophisticated.
It is. RC is essentially about feeding an adversary-specific, carefully crafted information. The goal is to incline them, to nudge them, towards making decisions that you want them to make, decisions that benefit you. It's basically a highly developed form of influence operation, a precursor to modern IW. And today, of course, the tools for IW are incredibly advanced technologically. We're talking about micro-targeting people on social media, creating online echo chambers to amplify certain narratives, even using platforms like Facebook and Twitter ads, as research has shown, to promote divisive movements. Things like Black Lives Matter alongside Blue Lives Matter seemingly just amplify societal divisions in places like the U.S.,
That's a really stark example of how it works in practice. And Ukraine itself, it's been a major laboratory, or maybe battleground, for this. You mentioned Crimea 2014. Even before the Little Green Men appeared, Russia had apparently penetrated Ukraine's information space, replacing Ukrainian TV broadcasts with Russian ones in some areas, pushing this constant stream of disinformation designed to justify intervention, to sow confusion. And remember the reports about those troll factories, supposedly posting over 111,000 tweets in just 3 days after Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down, instantly flooding the zone, blaming Ukraine, creating this dense fog of conspiracy theories. It really makes you wonder, how do you effectively counter that kind of pervasive, persistent info campaign, one that's designed specifically to confuse and mislead everyone?
And it goes beyond just narratives and online posts. IW also includes electronic warfare, EW. We saw examples in Ukraine where soldiers received demoralizing, subversive text messages directly on their phones, aimed at breaking troop morale, encouraging surrender. So it's not just about controlling the flow of information, but also about disrupting perception and communication right at the tactical edge.
Okay, so information and electronic warfare remain key tools. What else? You mentioned the Little Green Men, Special Operations Forces, SOF.
Yes. Russia formally established its Special Operations Forces Command, the KSSO, back in 2013, apparently prompted by lessons learned or deficiencies observed during the 2008 war in Georgia. And these SOF, yes, they were the archetypal Little Green Men in Crimea. They played that leading covert role, paralyzing local Ukrainian forces, securing key government buildings and infrastructure, often without firing a shot initially. They were also very likely involved in stirring up the insurgency movements in the Donbas region shortly after. And we've seen evidence of their presence in Syria, too, sometimes reportedly wearing patches of allied groups like Hezbollah, acting as military advisors. The key thing here, again, is the deniability. Russia could and did officially deny any link to their activities for a long time, makes it incredibly difficult to pin down and respond to directly.
That deniability theme keeps coming up. And another element that fits right into that is something almost oxymoronic. Government-organized non-governmental organizations. Go on, goes.
Right. Sounds contradictory, but it's a crucial part of the toolkit. These go-gos appear independent, like genuine civil society groups, but they're actually organized, funded, or directed by the government. They're used to push back against Western influence, promote Russian perspectives on world events, sort of soften the ground for policy.
How do they do that in practice?
They play a really important role in public diplomacy, promoting concepts like the Russian world, the Russkiy Mir. This idea aims to legitimize Russian policies, particularly towards countries with significant ethnic Russian populations, trying to mobilize those communities. A concrete example often cited is Viktor Medvedchuk's Ukrainian choice, Gongo in Ukraine. It actively pushed pro-Eurasian narratives, trying to undermine Ukraine's moves towards the West, and even attempted to obstruct the popular uprisings in 2004 and 2014. So, just like SOF, these Gongos offer a layer of deniability. They operate under the cover of civil society while potentially undermining Western democratic ideals and just generally creating confusion.
Okay, that's fascinating. And maybe one of the most, I don't know, surprising elements for some listeners, yet also deeply rooted, is the role of the Russian Orthodox Church, the ROC.
Yes, it's become increasingly clear, especially under Vladimir Putin, that the ROC has become a significant practical tool of Kremlin foreign policy. It's particularly instrumental in implementing that Russkiy Mir or Russian world doctrine we just mentioned.
So how does a religious institution become a geopolitical tool?
Well, the Russkiy Mir doctrine itself is framed as a challenge to the Western-led world order. It emphasizes Russia's perceived rightful sphere of influence, particularly over the Eastern Slavic world, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus. Based on shared language, culture, history, and crucially, Orthodox Christianity. So the ROC is actively used to promote a specific historical narrative, for instance, framing Kievan Rus, the medieval state centered in Kiev, as the foundational backbone of all Eastern Slavic nations, with Moscow as its rightful successor, which of course directly clashes with Ukraine's own national narrative, which also claims that Kievan Rus' legacy. It creates historical friction that can be exploited. It's really quite striking how deeply religion is being leveraged for strategic policy goals. You see figures like Konstantin Malofeyev, a prominent oligarch with close ties to the Kremlin and the church. He founded pro-Kremlin organizations, owns the Tsargrad TV channel, and uses these platforms to actively denigrate Western civilization and promote ROC and Orthodox values, often wrapped in anti-EU and anti-Western messaging.
So we've identified these enduring elements, IWEW, SOF, Gongos, even the ROC. These tools persist. But let's zoom out again. Let's talk about the why. Why did Russia adopt this kind of multifaceted hybrid approach in the first place? What drove this strategic direction?
I think it's deeply tied to specific needs and perceptions arising from some major events in Russia's recent history. Certainly, Vladimir Putin's rise to power and his stated ambition to restore Russia as a major world power, maybe reminiscent of the Soviet era, is a huge factor. You can see it in his speeches. His 2007 Munich Security Conference speech, where he heavily criticized the U.S. and NATO expansion, and then his 2014 Valdai speech, where he essentially blamed the U.S. for destabilizing the global order, these signal a clear intent to push back.
And specific military experiences must have played a role too, right? Like the Chechen Wars.
Absolutely. The Chechen Wars, particularly the first one from 1994 to 1996, seemed to be a really fundamental benchmark, a painful lesson. Russia went in with conventional military superiority, but suffered really significant humiliating losses. Why? Because the Chechen fighters used asymmetrical tactics, guerrilla warfare, things Russia wasn't prepared for. That experience brutally highlighted the need for Russia to reform its military thinking, to incorporate unconventional methods. It's a lesson that's actually referenced, implicitly perhaps, even in Gerasimov's 2013 article.
It raises that classic question, doesn't it? What happens when a big conventional military faces a determined unconventional foe? Russia felt that vulnerability, and that seems to have driven a major reevaluation.
Exactly. And then, adding to that, came the perception of what Russia saw as hybrid threats directed at them. Specifically, the series of color revolutions, Georgia in 2003, Ukraine's Orange Revolution in 2004, Kyrgyzstan in 2005, and later, the Arab Spring uprising starting around 2010. From Moscow's perspective, these weren't spontaneous popular movements. They saw them as Western-sponsored coups, using new tools like information technology, social media, NGOs, to destabilize regimes friendly to Russia. So this perception strongly reinforced their belief that they needed their own set of similar hybrid tools, both for defense and potentially for offense, including leveraging social media and other non-traditional actors.
So it's kind of a defensive adaptation that then morphs into an offensive capability.
Interesting.
Now, to put maybe a philosophical frame on this, Fuat Yaman's thesis suggests that Russia's hybrid warfare approach is guided by Machiavellian political philosophy. Can you unpack that?
Sure. The core idea there is that Machiavellian thought prioritizes the survival and well-being of the state above absolutely everything else. For a ruler, or the state, being virtuous in statecraft means doing whatever is necessary, including deception, manipulation, what Machiavelli called underhand measures, to achieve political goals and maintain the state's power and dignity. War, or conflict in its broader sense, isn't necessarily seen as an aberration. It's almost a constant necessity, a way to build virtue, which in this context means capability, strength, effectiveness.
So it's a very pragmatic, maybe even cynical view, where the ends justify the means if it ensures the state's survival and power.
Precisely. And this Machiavellian lens seems to align quite well with how Major Scott J. Haar described Russian actions using a literary metaphor. He talked about Russia expanding Tolstoy, meaning blurring the lines between war and peace, operating in that ambiguous gray zone between the two states, and simultaneously shrinking Dostoevsky, meaning reducing the perceived criminal boundaries or legal moral constraints on national activities when pursuing state objectives, essentially normalizing actions that might otherwise be seen as illicit. You know, the U.S. traditionally thinks about its instruments of power, diplomacy, information, military, economic, the dime model, often as somewhat separate tools. Haar suggests Russia's approach is more like a cursive dime, highly integrated, almost seamless flow between these national instruments, constantly working together, with information operations acting as a critical linchpin, often aiming to influence situations, maybe even achieve regime change, without necessarily resorting to large-scale kinetic combat, if possible.
A cursive dime? That's a really powerful image. It suggests a fluidity and integration that's maybe different from how the West often approaches these things. Okay, so let's try to pull this all together. What does this mean for you, our listener, trying to make sense of it all? We've seen that while hybrid warfare, maybe as that specific Western-defined playbook, seems less dominant in Russia's current brutal campaign in Ukraine, the underlying strategic thinking, the principles, and many of the tools, they're still deeply ingrained in Russian military and political thought. From that long history of maskirovka right up to sophisticated modern information warfare, the use of SOF, Janjus, even leveraging the ROC, Russia continues to show a flexible, adaptable, and often deliberately deniable approach to achieving its goals, driven by what it perceives as its own strategic necessities.
Yeah, understanding this isn't straightforward. It's complex. It's multi-layered. But grasping this approach is really crucial if you want to comprehend the evolving landscape of global security. It reminds us that conflict isn't just about tanks and troops anymore. It's also about perception, information, influence, and these often invisible battles fought constantly in that gray zone.
Which leaves us with a pretty important question to ponder, doesn't it? If the very definition of war seems to be shifting, if those lines between peace and conflict, between military and non-military action are getting increasingly blurry, how should nations and maybe even how should individuals prepare for a future where conflict can show up in these deniable, ambiguous, multi-domain ways?
That's profound thought to end on. And for more insights into these kinds of strategic security policy issues, to continue your own deep dive into actionable knowledge, do visit thesecuritynexus.net.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.